Have you been scared by headlines suggesting that sleep disruption early in life can cause memory issues later on? If so, you're in the same boat as Eileen, who has pointed us to a study that we are going to take a critical look at today. And we're going to find, as we have so many times, that there's no reason for concern, but lots of reasons to not worry and find peaceful sleep and peace of mind.
What a change had been so profound that I looked full at the problem in the face. Like, okay, insomnia, do your worst. I'm not running from you. I'm not going to be scared. It's just sometimes it's just so simple. Like the truth has to be simple. Otherwise, it's not the truth.
I was so trapped in my head before. When I say my whole life changed, like my whole life changed.
I'm Coach Daniel, and this is the Sleep Coach School.
Welcome back to Herd Online. Hope you're doing really well. And in the study we're going to look at today, we're going to find some common elements, you know. And, you know, I think it's worthwhile for you to stay with me in this examination because we're going to find some really, really surprising things. You know, not for me, but surprising in the context of how the results of the study were portrayed initially. And we're going to see that there was actually this amazing opportunity to like really reassure people and say there's nothing to worry about, you know, from the results of the study. And again, a lost opportunity to really do something wonderful in the world. But anyway, enough of me talking, let's jump into it. So Eileen, a member of our community, submitted this article for a potential Herd Online episode. This is from a site called eatingwell.com. It's under news, and the headline reads, "Can disrupted sleep impact your memory later in life? New study says yes." And we have our triggerometer, you know, basically a numeric value of how triggering a title is from 0 to 5. I think this is like a 4. This is quite triggering. I would ask you to remember this title because we're going to return to it in just a second. But in this article from Eating, the author points to the actual research study that they are, you know, deriving this one from. So we are going to head to the actual research study and see what, you know, what was actually found by this California group in California. And the title of the actual study that was published in Neurology, January 3rd this year, is "Association Between Sleep Quantity and Quality in Early Adulthood with Cognitive Function in Midlife," which is a great title, you know, very neutral and just, you know, describing what is being studied. Now, we have access to the abstract, which you see in front of you here. And there's lots here that's really interesting. We're going to skip the background, but just jump into methods. So here it says, as part of the coronary artery risk development in young adults, cohort study sleep duration and quality were assessed objectively using risk actigraphy and subjectively using the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index. In other words, there was this kind of big study, or a, you know, relatively big study, like a cohort, like when you have a bunch of people and you kind of follow them over many, many years. And as part of that study, as part of the data gathering from that study, there was some data on sleep. So I think the authors here decided to look at the specifically like the sleep data and some cognitive data that were already available for them. They had a total of 526 participants, a little bit more women, and 44% were Black, and the mean age was 40. And here it starts getting interesting. So they had, again, some objective measures of sleep duration, which is actigraphy, which generally speaking is quite accurate. And they found that the mean sleep duration was 6.1 hours plus minus 1.1 hour. And I just want to stop right there for a second and ponder this. So you have a, you know, fairly big study as far as sleep studies go, like 520 some subjects. They do risk actigraphy and find that the mean sleep duration was about 6 hours plus minus 1 hours, which means that if you imagine like a bell-shaped curve, then kind of the top of the bell would be like 6 hours. And, you know, one standard deviation either way would be like 7 and 5. So it was kind of completely unremarkable if somebody would sleep like 4.3, 4.5 hours up to like, you know, 7.5 hours would be kind of completely unremarkable, right? And you contrast this with what you always hear, that you should sleep 8 hours, right? Ideally, maybe 9 hours, right? When in reality, as I've said so many times over the course of the years, objectively measured sleep duration in human adults is about 6 hours. Now, this is one opportunity for reassurance. Like, the headline of this study could be like, you know, objective sleep duration much lower than typically recommended. I think that would lead to so much relief, so much less pressure to sleep, so much less sleep anxiety in the world if that had been highlighted. So I want to take the opportunity to look at that one. That you know, was a really nice finding, I think. Now, they also measure something they call mean sleep fragmentation index. I've never heard of that before. But what they do is they calculate the sum of the percentage of time spent moving and the percentage of immobile periods for less than a minute. They got this sleep fragmentation index to 19.2. That was the mean. And now, you know, the reason I bring that up is that I've never heard that term before, this sleep fragmentation index. Maybe that says more about me than, you know, the researchers. I don't know. But whenever there's kind of a new terminology that isn't really established, that makes me think maybe the research kind of like put the data together in a new way, in a new creative way, to find something positive, to find, not positive as in kind of like uplifting and nice, but positive as in like a positive research finding, to find something. It's very hard to publish something if you can't say, oh, look, this causes that, or this is related with this, or we found something, right? So researchers always want to find something that's linked with something else. Otherwise, it has little news value, right? So when I hear some new terminology like this, I'm always kind of a little bit suspicious. Like, were they kind of creative here of finding some new measure that, you know, led to them finding some positive correlation that they could report? You know, that's just my thoughts on that. Now, here's another interesting part. 239, so 45% of the participants reported poor sleep as defined by, you know, the PSQ, like this Pittsburgh Quality of Sleep Index and a global score. This was also really interesting to me. You took, I believe this is kind of a random sample of people at a certain age, 45% reported poor sleep, which, you know, makes you wonder how is that possible? Why is that? You know, is it partly because we're told that we should sleep a certain way and that way we're supposed to sleep or told to sleep is like unrealistic, and we're trying to pursue something that is not real, and we then think we're falling short, and we think, and that's the reason why this is so high, this number is so high, 45%? Or is it maybe how this questionnaire is worded? But anyway, what I want to highlight here as a potential source of reassurance is the highlight of this could be like, you know, having an experience of not sleeping well is very, very common, you know, and that could be very reassuring. You know, a lot of people could be like, oh, I'm not the only one who thinks I'm not sleeping well, right? The 45% of the population thinks so. Oh, I'm not strange. I'm not unusual. That was another great opportunity, in my opinion, for kind of a really nice reassuring message. But that was not what was reported upon. So we shall continue looking into this article we have in front of us. And next it goes to kind of what they think of as kind of the meat of study. After adjustments for demographics, education, smoking, et cetera, they found that when they compared like the lowest and highest tertile of sleep fragmentation index, there was a higher odds of having poor cognitive performance. And poor cognitive performance was measured by this digit substitution test, where basically you're given a chart where, you know, one is an arrow, two is an arrow down, three is a zero or something. Like, and then you're given a big chart, and then you're supposed to like be like, oh, a two is a zero. I changed this for this, change that. So it's supposed to kind of check your focus and you know, attention. And so they again saw that the people with the highest amount of what they call sleep fragmentation, with the highest sleep fragmentation scores, also were not doing so well on this particular task. That is what they found, right? Now, what they say lastly in their the results section here is this: objective sleep duration or subjective sleep quality was not associated with cognition in midlife. In other words, there were two big negatives right there. If you ask people how they feel they slept and they said, I sleep so-and-so. That was not associated with cognitive performance. And sleep duration was not. You know, if people had short sleep versus longer sleep, that didn't make a difference in terms of like cognitive performance, right? That could have been a great title, really, really assuring. Like if you sleep, you know, 4.5 hours or 5 hours, that showed no impact on cognitive performance. That could have been a great title. So, so reassuring. Now, how about what they found here? Well, firstly, again, I've never heard of this particular marker for sleep quality that the authors propose here. But I think more importantly, it doesn't prove any type of causality. You know, firstly, when you have a great data set, like I'm guessing these authors had access to like a whole bunch of different data points. And then they could, of course, be creative and combine these data points into like, you know, different indices, etc. You're going to find something that correlates with something else, you know, and the statistical truth is when something is less than 5% likely to be associated with something else, but it is, then it's true. Like, so in other words, if you check like the impact of like, let's say like cognitive ability, like they did, and you had 40 variables that you randomly picked in someone's life, like whether they have cats or not, if they like ketchup or not, if they're right-handed or left-handed or you know, things like that, you would find two things, statistically speaking, that would be correlated without them causing any issue with cognition, of course. So one thing that can explain this finding is maybe just coincidence, you know, nothing else, coincidence. And maybe it can be something like somebody who is more of, let's say, an active sleeper, it also tends to have kind of a active mind and they're not so focused. You know, that could explain it without there being any reason for concern whatsoever. Or maybe it could be like somebody who's more an active sleeper is kind of a driven type A, like, you know, intelligent person who finds this digital substitution task like so like unchallenging, right? Like they're just like, oh, this is too easy for me. They go slowly, right? Or something like that. That could also explain it, right? There is nothing. Absolutely nothing that I can see in the study that is any reason for concern whatsoever. On the other hand, we had many things, the sleep duration, the lack of association with short sleep, the lack of association with subjective sleep quality, the fact that 45% of a general population reports, you know, having some unsatisfactory sleep, normalization of that, all those four things could have been really, really great to highlight, to reduce sleep anxiety and lead you know, people to peaceful sleep and peace of mind. So this concludes today's Heard Online. And I'm hopeful, of course, that together we as a community can really help educate the world in a different way that leads to where we all want to be again, peaceful sleep and peace of mind. So I'll say thank you so much for tuning in here and look forward to having you back real soon. Until then, take care. That was all for today. I hope you found this episode really eye-opening. And if you're looking for something more tangible, then head over to our website, thesleepcoachschool.com, and you'll find several coaching options where our teachings can be contextualized for you personally. If you decide to join, we look forward to seeing you on the other side.